Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We are having APB Bolton for Newt Gingrich. We'll get him in just a moment or two, hopefully. Remember, Newt Gingrich, interesting, former Speaker of the House, Fox News contributor. He's got a new book out called The American Majority, March to the Majority, The Real Story of the Republican Revolution. That was back in the mid-90s, a very successful revolution, I might add. And I'm quite interested in how he handled Bill Clinton in those days relative to how Kevin McCarthy is handling Joe Biden. But, one of the key points right now, I want to just go circle back on this debt ceiling business, because what really matters here, and it's partly a budget issue, but more broadly, it's going to be a presidential leadership issue. And that is simply that the GOP, which has the House, is very important. The House has all money bills originate in the House. The House is where all tax bills must originate. They have the power of the purse. You know, this is about restoring real prosperity to America. Now, you know, steady listeners may have heard me say this in the past, but I will repeat it. The United States grew in real terms, adjusted for inflation, between 1947, after World War II, and the year 2000. The U.S. grew at 3.5% per year for 50 years, 50 plus years, okay, 47 to 2000. Really quite remarkable. And by the way, we had recessions. I think we had 11 recessions and 12 recoveries or something like that. But that was a remarkable period of American prosperity. And that prosperity benefited everybody across the board, created phenomenal opportunities. Whether we can replicate that or not remains to be seen. But in the last almost 25 years, our growth rate has fallen back to about 1.5%, 1.7, 1.8%, under 2%. And that's one of the reasons, for example, that we have these huge budget deficits. We are not producing enough economic growth from business and consumers and employment to cover our spending. And the welfare state has grown larger, and central planning has grown larger. And unfortunately, some of this has happened during Republican administrations and as well as Democratic administrations. We have not solved our prosperity problem. And basic building blocks of prosperity, low tax rates, minimal regulations, price stability, a sound, reliable dollar, restrained, limited government and government spending, which includes, you know, that's the real source of the debt problem, is we just spend too much. This has got to be the number one issue in this campaign, and it's got to be the number one longer-term issue. You know, you see these very bad long-term debt estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, where debt to GDP will rise. You know, right now it's running around 100%, which is just itself way too high. Right, let me stop blathering and bring in my friend Newt Gingrich. We found him. He's former Speaker of the House, as you know. Brilliant Fox News contributor. Hey, Newt. Newt, glad we got hold of you. Thank you for Memorial Day. As always, best to Ambassador Calista. And I want to talk to you. You know, you've got this book, March to the Majority, The Real Story of the Republican Revolution. It's coming out, what, June 6th. Some of it's already up on Amazon, I think, but I want to just start by talking about, you know, what you did then and what are the lessons learned and how you dealt with Bill Clinton how you got your contract with America, which included work requirements and lower taxes and economic growth, and what can we take from that in terms of today's battles over the debt ceiling and the fact that we have a very poor economy right now with virtually no growth and high inflation. What can we learn, Newt Gingrich?
Hello. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I got you. I can hear you.
I hear you fine. Or good. I did.
I can hear you, Newt. Our listeners can hear you. All right, we're going to try on another line. Again, I come back to this my prosperity argument, which Newt will fill in the gaps in just a moment. We get him on a different line. But this has got to be – I mean, here's a statistic for you. I don't want to get into the weeds, but look, Joe Biden's been president for 2 years plus, almost 2.5 years now, and middle-class wages, blue-collar, middle-income wages – adjusted for inflation, have fallen 7%. Actually, I believe the number 7.3% in his term. All right, here's Newt back on a better line, hopefully.
Good. Can you hear me okay?
I can. I got you.
Great. Good. Well, I'm delighted to chat with you, and this could be a pretty exciting weekend. I think they're very likely going to end up with a debt ceiling agreement that is going to be remarkably positive for exactly what you're concerned about. In lower taxes, less spending, and greater opportunity for people to create jobs and go to work.
Newt, go back 25 years. You had to handle Bill Clinton. We captured the Congress, the contract with America. Ultimately, with lower taxes and less spending and work requirements and so forth, you wound up a tremendous prosperity that actually balanced the budget and created surpluses. What can we take from that experience a while back, and what can we take from that experience today in the debate? Because I think this debt ceiling debate is really just the beginning of the debate. It could be a turning point for conservative economics, but we'll see. Anyway, what can you tell us from your book?
Yeah. Well, I just wrote March to the Majority, which takes the whole period of this, the 16 years we worked to create a majority, the first majority in 40 years, and then the 4 years we negotiated with Clinton. And March to the Majority is really kind of a cookbook of how you do it. And I have to say, I think with Speaker McCarthy so far, is doing a very good job of following that game plan, which starts with the American people. I mean, Lincoln once said, with popular sentiment, anything is possible. Without popular sentiment, nothing is possible. And Reagan, in his farewell address, said all of his greatest victories were won by the American people, not by him, because they told Congress what they wanted. So you start with the notion that you have to have big goals, getting back to a work requirement, for example, which we did with welfare reform, controlling spending, having the kind of tax cuts, and equally important, having the kind of regulatory changes that make it easier for people to create jobs and be entrepreneurs and start companies. All of these things are a practical playbook, which, frankly, when you were in the Reagan White House, you were helping develop and implement it. It goes back to the 70s. And people like Art Laffer, Jack Kemp, and Reagan picking up the whole theme of supply-side economics and the idea that the way you defeat inflation is you create more jobs, more products, more goods and services. So you're mopping up the extra money by providing extra things that people can get, which is very different than what the Federal Reserve is trying to do now, which is a classic demand side. Let's punish everybody until they're so poor that we don't have any inflation because nobody can spend anything. And I think that it's really important, and I agree with you. I think the debt ceiling agreement that we're going to see is going to be a step. It's not the whole journey, but it is a clear step towards lower taxes, less spending, and less regulation. And if they follow up on that, I think the House Republicans will release a balanced budget proposal that gets us to balance within 10 years, and that will have a big economic growth component. Because, as you know, you're the one, I mean, you're really the greatest teacher about this now. When you get to 3.5% growth and you get back to a normal, dynamic America, it's amazing how much revenue that generates, not by raising taxes, but by raising prosperity.
You know, this supply-side model, which is so important in the Reagan Revolution, and which you carried forward through the contract with America, to some extent it's been lost. There's a bunch of us that are trying to restore it. We saw good brief glimpses of it during the Trump years. He was there on lower taxes and regulations, very, very important stuff. But, you know, you had a balanced budget way back then, and I know you and I have talked about this in the last year or two. The principle of a balanced budget is so important, and you can have a pro-growth balanced budget. In fact, growth is essential. High growth and low inflation is essential to a balanced budget. Now, let me just ask you this. You spent a lot of time with Bill Clinton, all right? And yep. In some vague way, you know, Clinton, I mean, he sort of vaguely understood this, but talk to us, give us a little history about those conversations with Clinton. Did he understand what you were pushing him to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Clinton had been governor for a long time in Arkansas, which is a very conservative state. And Clinton understood the essence of having a lower tax system. He campaigned as a centrist, and he had spent a number of years trying to help the Democratic Party go back to the center. But once he got elected, sadly for him and wonderfully for us, the congressional Democrats talked him into being vastly more liberal in his first 2 years in office. And he broke the coalition which had elected him and gave us the chance to win, because they brought up things like a tax on energy. Well, America is a big country where people travel a lot and where people in the Northeast worry about the cost of fuel oil, heating oil, and people around the country worry about the cost of natural gas and the cost of gasoline. So they got the House Democrats to ram through without a single Republican vote a tax increase that was wildly unpopular. The Senate Democrats wouldn't even take it up. So they felt that the House Democrats had been sort of hung out to dry. Then they went after guns in a way which infuriated rural America. And you go through a whole series of these things. And by 94, Clinton was defeated in a shocking scale of landslide. Nobody expected a Republican House, but we also picked up the Senate. We picked up governorships. We picked up state legislators. And Clinton, who was a very practical guy, he'd won in 78 as the youngest governor in the country and lost in 80. And spent 2 years worrying about having lost because he didn't have much money, and that meant he lost the governor's mansion, the car, the airplane, the state police, you know. And so he really wanted to get back to be governor again. Plus, he was an ambitious guy, and he wanted to someday be president. So there was a big fight in the White House in June of 95, and all of his liberal staff said to him, you know, you have to take Gingrich head on. You have to fight for our values. You have to stand firm for liberalism. And he said to them, you know, if I do what you want me to, I'm going to get beat in 96. But if I work with Gingrich, I might be able to get reelected. And I ain't going to do what you want me to. And we had, when we were negotiating, there were a couple of times, for example, when Leon Panetta, who at that time was his chief of staff, would literally jump up in anger and yell at him and say, you can't do that. We lost control of the House because we did that. And if you repeal it, it'll make everything we sacrificed, you know, useless. And Clinton would just stare at him. I mean, I'd never quite seen a president dressed down by his chief of staff before. And, you know, and then he would say, well, maybe I can't do all of it. And then he'd do half of it. And so you could move him. I mean, people forget, and this is where I'm really pleased with the way that Speaker McCarthy is operating, because he's going down to see the president. They are having conversations. I met with Clinton on 35 different days in order to get a balanced budget agreement. And you know, you had to sit in a room and you had to talk it out. But he was a guy you could talk with. You know, I couldn't imagine trying to do that with Barack Obama.
Boy. Newt, let me just take a quick commercial break. I want to come back and continue exactly this conversation. And I want to raise the point that Ronald Reagan beat Jimmy Carter on the economy, and that Bill Clinton beat Papa Bush on the economy, and the Republicans had their heyday on the economy. And you're right. Kevin McCarthy understands that. The question is, do our presidential candidates understand that? Folks, we're talking to Newt Gingrich, of course, former Speaker of the House, Fox News contributor. His new book, March to the Majority, The Real Story of the Republican Revolution, is coming out June 6th. It's available for pre-order. I'm Kudlow. We'll be back with Newt Gingrich in just a moment.
Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. We're talking with the great Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, best-selling author, Fox News contributor. His new book is called March to the Majority, The Real Story of the Republican Revolution. It's out June 6th, available for pre-order. Newt, thanks for doing this on Memorial Day weekend. So point I wanted to hammer home on is Ronald Reagan beat Jimmy Carter on the economy in 1980. Bill Clinton beat Papa Bush on the economy in 1992. Now, Clinton went left. You clobbered him in the midterm elections, and then Clinton went to the right. It just seems to me that this presidential election is going to be a pocketbook election on the economy. It's going to be whether the GOP can persuade voters that they are the stewards of economic prosperity. Can they produce a balanced budget? Can they get inflation down? Can they promote supply-side growth policies? You did it way back when. It's been done in small doses. The question is, can it be done in a larger dose now? Can the GOP be successful?
Well, I think they can, and I think that the message of opportunity, the message of a successful America, is a very powerful, very compelling message. And, you know, I watched Senator Tim Scott, for example, announce the other day for president, and he did a great job of talking in a positive way, almost like Reagan. Reagan always believed that the future would be better, and it's just remarkable. You know, even in Reagan's last public statements as he was dealing with Alzheimer's, he still had a positive comment about the future of America, because he just, that's who he was. It was deep in his soul. I think that the American people are hungry for leadership, and this is part of why I think the House Republicans are off to an amazingly good start, because they're being positive. They're offering hope, and they're doing it on a number of things. I mean, people don't always realize, for example, if they get in this deal on the debt ceiling, they get the right kind of permitting reform, they suddenly make infrastructure investment and oil and gas investment dramatically more desirable. And you begin to get a virtuous circle where, and this is part of how we got to 4 years of a balanced budget. And frankly, when I left office, Alan Greenspan, then the chairman of the Federal Reserve, had given a speech saying that they thought that they might pay off the national debt by 2009. Mm. And they had a study group at the Federal Reserve trying to figure out, how do you manage the money supply if you have no debt?
yes.
Now, you know, George W. Bush didn't have a clue what we were doing. And they promptly deviated and didn't understand the enormous long-term value of the discipline of a balanced budget. It forces you to think about what you're spending. It forces you to set priorities. It forces you to cut out waste and fraud. We've been in a period of just, as Reagan used to say, he would say we were spending like drunken sailors, but he didn't want to insult the sailors because we were actually spending a lot more than a drunken sailor would. And that was part of his campaign against Carter. He had a great line, by the way. You may remember this because you were so deeply involved in it, but he had this thing where he said, you know, if your brother-in-law is laid off, it's called a recession. If you're laid off, it's called a depression. If Jimmy Carter's laid off, it's called a recovery.
That's right. I absolutely love that. So the key to a balanced budget, I mean, I think the country yearns for a balanced budget. It's an odd issue, but I think it sounds like it's a sort of, you know, boring issue, but I think people want that. They may not know exactly why, but I think that, you know, our fiscal house has got to be in order to get the country back in order.
Right. You know, look, I think part of it's moral. Part of it is the personal experience. Families know they can't run big deficits forever. Small business owners know you can't run a big deficit forever. And we have a project, as you know, called America's New Majority Project, which people can see if they go to americasnewmajorityproject.com. And we do a lot of very extensive polling. And I would say that something like 80% of the American people favor a balanced budget and believe it's an important thing to do. About 10 or 12% oppose it, mostly government employees and government contractors who want the money. But I think overwhelmingly it's a positive popular issue. I think the more you talk about it, the more popular it's going to get. I think that Jody Arrington, as the Budget Committee Chairman, is right at the beginning of riding a wave that will be amazing. You see breakthroughs every day in technology and new opportunities and new efficiencies. You apply those to the government, you can really have dramatically better government with a lot lower budget. And frankly, the American people instinctively believe that the federal government has huge levels of waste, and they're right. I mean, you look at the thefts, for example. California had $20 billion stolen in unemployment compensation. I mean, it's staggering to think you have bureaucracies that are that incompetent.
And I don't want to lose your theme. We're running out of time here, but big government socialism loses in the polling overwhelmingly to free market capitalism.
Absolutely. It's a huge opportunity for all of us who are conservatives. The country is seeing Biden fail. We need to make it a program failure, not a personal failure, and get them to understand that our way works.
Newt Gingrich, The March to Majority, comes out June 6th, folks. You got to go out and buy that book. Thank you, Newt. Happy Memorial Day. Folks, I'm Kudlow. We're going to take a break. On the other side of the break, we're going to talk a little bit about presidential politics. How's that?
Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show, and we bring in my longtime pal, Roger Stone, veteran political consultant and strategist, worked for Nixon, Reagan, Trump. Anyway, Roger Stone, how are you?
Great to be back with you, Larry.
Yeah, thanks for doing this on Memorial Day. We appreciate it. Roger, I wanted to talk some presidential politics. Nobody knows this stuff better than you do. We had two announcements last week. One of them was Tim Scott, Senator Scott of South Carolina. And, of course, the big one was Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. Actually, what do you think of the Tim Scott story, Roger Stone? What do you think? Let's just start with that for a moment and then go to DeSantis.
Well, potentially interesting, Larry. He had a more conventional and traditional announcement. One of the ways you run for vice president is, of course, running for president and doing a little better than people expect. I could see a lot of scenarios under which Tim Scott might be a viable vice presidential candidate, and therefore someday a more viable presidential candidate. But, obviously anytime an African-American emerges as a significant and viable Republican presidential candidate, it's a viable news story. I think Tim Scott's got a lot of upside potential.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I thought he did very well. By the way, I like traditional announcements. I think it's a good thing. Speaking of which, Governor DeSantis's Twitter feed announcement was neither traditional nor successful. As the feed broke down, I think what saved it partially was he had a good interview with Trey Gowdy of Fox News later on, so people could get a better sense of what he stood for and who he was. But what was your take on the DeSantis announcement, first of all? Let's start there.
First of all, we live in a visual, universe, a visual communications system. And I thought it was very interesting. It was very good for Twitter, by the way, and good for Elon Musk. And that's a good thing because I think Twitter is beginning to emerge as a real alternative to the legacy media. Clearly, when Tucker Carlson heads there to do a Twitter-based show, which I think is imminent, it's going to shift a lot of the ground over there, and Twitter's going to continue to be an important political outlet. On the other hand, the problem with this is you couldn't see DeSantis. You couldn't see whether he was reading his opening remarks. I have a feeling the questions were carefully scripted, as were the answers. By the way, I applied to ask a question. It's funny, Larry, I wasn't accepted. But I think it speaks to the larger question of whether DeSantis can perform in an unscripted atmosphere, in an atmosphere in which he doesn't control the microphone. He doesn't seem to be very good on his feet. And then secondarily, you cannot run for president without submitting yourself ultimately to a full press conference. There's a lot of questions about his conduct in Florida, a lot of questions about changes in the state law that make his travels and the expenses for his travels and his security a secret. They heretofore were under our state sunshine law. He took a multi-million dollar book advance from HarperCollins, which is the News Corporation. They're not going to sell $10 million worth of books. I think you got to be able to take these questions in an open format. And he's so far, he has gone to all controlled situations. I agree with you. His interview with Trey Gowdy was pretty good. His interview with Mark Levin was pretty good. But again, friendly questioners in both cases.
You know, Roger, we were just talking with Newt Gingrich in the earlier segment, and this is going to be, in large measure, a pocketbook election, okay? In some sense, the way Reagan beat Carter was on the economy. The way Clinton beat Papa Bush was on the economy. It's the economy, stupid. I think this one's going to be quite similar. I know DeSantis is a smart guy. I know he inherited a zero income tax in Florida from past Republican administrations. But I don't see an economic growth and prosperity agenda. It's my single biggest critique of Governor DeSantis. He's woke is fine up to a point, but I think he's gone too far. I don't think he can beat Trump or Biden unless he has a far, far better economic growth agenda.
I think there's three legs to the stool, Larry. One is an economic growth agenda. He has not put one forward. Secondarily is a more cogent foreign policy, particularly one centered around the dangers of China and the communist Chinese, went unmentioned in his announcement pretty much anywhere. And then lastly are the cultural issues. But we cannot certainly win on the cultural issues alone. And that seems to be what drives him. So I agree with your analysis. I think there are a lot of missing pieces. Add on top of all that immigration at our southern border. So I don't think you have a full and broad candidacy at this point.
He's down 30-40 points to Trump right now in the primaries. Can he make that back? What does he have to do to make that back?
Well, look, everything is going to be, as it has always been, contingent on what happens in these early primary and caucus states. Reagan was leading George H.W. Bush by 18 when Bush pulled an upset in the Iowa caucuses simply by physically outworking Reagan. I was there, of course, working for Reagan. Reagan's folks, we made a miscalculation thinking that Reagan could just parachute into the state, give a couple speeches and leave, and that we would win. Trump cannot, in my opinion, and I'm strongly supporting President Trump, just to be clear, but I don't think he can make the same error and get outworked in any of these early contests. He's a strong front runner. There's huge intensity and loyalty among his voters. They're unlikely to leave him. He has enough votes in both states, in all three early states, to win a multi-candidate contest now, but he's going to have to identify and turn out those votes. He cannot allow DeSantis to outwork him. He can't outthink him, but he can outwork him, and the president cannot allow that. I don't think he will, by the way.
Shouldn't Trump debate?
I think it will be absolutely crucial to debate at the end of the day. On the other hand, Trump should debate on his own terms. He shouldn't debate when Fox demands it. He should not do it when the Republican National Committee demands it. You can't really have a debate unless the front runner is involved. So Trump is in a very strong position to dictate the conditions and the dates of the debates. But ultimately, I think it will be required.
You think he should go? The first debate is in August out in Milwaukee. You think he should do it?
Not necessarily. I think he should look at his options. Again, the race can't begin without the front runner. A debate can't be real without the front runner. A debate between Ron DeSantis and all the other candidates, my guess is the other candidates really all understand they need to get up and over DeSantis before they can get to Trump. Attacking Trump with his, you know, deep intensity of support is really dangerous. So a debate without Trump would end up being a pile-on for Governor DeSantis, and there's plenty to talk about there.
That's an interesting point. It would be a pile-on. It would be like playing the semifinals before you get into the finals of the tennis tournament. Roger, you're for Trump. How is Trump in the CNN debate, I'm going to call it? I know it's a town hall, but it was really a debate with that woman. How's his messaging so far, Roger Stone?
I can't think of any other public figure, and that includes Ron DeSantis, who could go into that kind of lion's den and emerge, I think, as the dominant winner. I mean, he is at his best when he's under pressure. And you saw a very combative, aggressive, assertive Trump. No, he's not going to stop saying that he thinks the election was stolen from him because he believes it was. There's a lot of evidence to that effect. He is not going to back off any of his current positions. So I think he went in there and dominated in a very, very hostile situation where the moderator was also essentially his opponent. So I can't imagine that anyone else can do that kind of unscripted job. I thought it was a triumph, in all honesty.
I did, too. I think he hit a home run. I also, Roger, from my lights on the economy, I thought Trump messaged very well. You know, in a sense, the turning point in that debate for the nationwide audience was when he said, drill, baby, drill. And then he walked right through his achievements on taxes and regulations and economic growth. I mean, to me, that's the stuff of a victory.
Well, politics is always about the future. It's never about the past. The good thing about Trump is that he can lay out a plan which is really basically back to the future, meaning he's a proven performer, particularly on the economy. You're talking about the greatest rate of job creation in our history, the greatest rate of wage growth, the lowest levels of unemployment among Black Americans, white Americans, Hispanic Americans, young, old, urban, rural. I mean, it's a stunning economic record. You know, Larry, because you were there helping implement his programs. That will be the central economy, the central issue. What's going to, I think they're fudging these unemployment numbers. I think the Fed, you know, manipulates them because, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, manipulates them. I don't think the reality is not nearly as rosy as the Biden administration tells us. You'd be in a better position to tell me what will happen in terms of inflation, but I think there's very little chance the economy will be stronger today in 2024 by November than it is today. And Trump's got a proven track record, which he has huge credibility both in the foreign policy realm and in terms of his being the one guy with the credibility to end the war in Ukraine. He's the guy who cut off the Russian pipeline. He's the guy who gave Ukrainians offensive missiles. He's got the credibility to negotiate a settlement and do it before the Biden administration stumbles us into World War III.
Yeah, you know, that's almost a sleeper point, Roger. We've got to go. But, you know, it's Joe Biden's war, and he's spending a fortune on the war, and the war looks like a stalemate. And Trump says, stop the killing, stop the killing. I think that was a huge plus in that CNN town hall. I really do. I think Americans are getting, we love freedom and democracy, but you have to be somewhat realistic about these things, too.
And I think Trump has a unique ability to run as the peace candidate, as the one candidate who could bring this war to a conclusion and stop the killing. Look, the Russians would never have moved on Ukraine. The Chinese would never move on Taiwan because of the unpredictability of Donald Trump. And he's the one guy with the negotiating chops, I think, proven to end this war. That is going to be a huge sleeper issue.
Yeah, 100%. Roger Stone, thank you ever so much. Great to talk to you. Great to hear your voice. We'll talk soon. Folks, I'm Kudlow. We're going to take a quick break, and then Betsy McCoy is going to come in, talk about her great New York Post column. Why can't we bust shoplifters, for heaven's sakes? I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show.